Hello and welcome back to the Diversity in Research podcast. My name's Lachlan Smith.
And I'm Jakob Feldfast Christensen. Today, our guest is Nicola Reevely. She is a Principal Research Fellow in the Mental Health Literacy Program at the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health at the University of Melbourne. And we had a chat with her about mental health and mental health issues. This is, of course, always an interesting topic, but of course, during these COVID times, and she's situated in Melbourne, and they have been in a very, very long lockdown, and they were just preparing to see it finishing when we talked to her. And so we had some discussion about some general topics about mental health as a minority position. At the end of the interview, we also talked a bit about the COVID-19 situation for us all. So we hope you enjoy our talk with Nicola.
So we are joined here now by Nicola Reevely, who is a Principal Research Fellow at the Mental Health Literacy Program at the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health at the University of Melbourne. Welcome, Nicola.
Thank you.
So you, as your title indicates, of course, you work with mental health,
which is always important, but during this COVID time with lockdowns all over the world is, of course, even more important. But to just start a bit off, we thought we could start with some definitions. That's a nice academic way of approaching things. So when we talk about mental health and mental health issues, that covers a variety of issues. So could you perhaps start by defining what we mean when we say mental health and mental health issues? What is covered and what is not covered? Because we tend to talk about it in the singular, and that's probably wrong.
So that's there can be like a short, more straightforward answer to that, and there can be a longer, more complicated answer. So terminology is a bit of a contested area in the area of mental health. I think mental health is, there are various definitions of that, and the important thing to probably think about when we talk about mental health is that it's not merely the absence of illness, that it is much more than that. Mental health conditions, mental health issues are words you increasingly hear. Some of the more, the psychiatrists might use the term mental disorders, mental illness, but there's been a move away from using those terms because there's an idea that you might stigmatize a person by labeling them as having a mental disorder. So there really has been a move away from the use of some of those terms. And, for some diagnostic terms, people would prefer not to be given those labels, and they would argue that there is really no such thing as mental illness. And they, we all exist along a continuum of symptoms, whether that's mood, or for some people that might be hearing voices. So while you ask me what might seem quite a simple question, it's actually not for a lot of people.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
No, but I think that is true, and that is where, of course, also why we ask you on the podcast, because I think that, as we'll come into later, it is what makes this particularly tricky, probably when it comes to a talk about diversity, particularly. But what led you to work with mental health, and especially mental health and the workplace? And you have published in that particular area several times.
So most of the work that I do is in the area of mental health literacy and stigma. So mental health literacy, the term was coined by Professor Tony Jorm, who I've been lucky enough to work with. He's sort of semi-retired now, but I was lucky enough to work with him for quite a long time. And really, that's defined as people's knowledge and beliefs about mental illness, if you want to use this term, or mental health problems, and, you know, their prevention and treatment and anything around that. So that term was coined really by work that showed what we sometimes call the help-seeking gap or the treatment gap. So when you do surveys in populations, and you really, you take people through a series of questions, and on the basis of those questions, you might say that they'd be quite likely to meet a diagnosis of something like depression or anxiety or PTSD, anxiety and condition or disorder. And then when you often, you can get that a certain proportion of people in a survey like that might meet the criteria. But then when you ask those people, did they get professional help? In high-income countries where there's services, you kind of tend to find that are only around 30% of people that might meet the criteria would have got some professional help. In low-middle-income countries where the health systems are much less resourced, the treatment gap is much bigger. It could be up to 85 or 90%. Yeah. So, you know, a few decades ago, really, maybe sort of three decades ago, there was a lot of effort kind of put into, okay, we want to narrow this gap. You know, we want people who may have meet the criteria for a mental illness. We want to make sure they get professional help. So a lot of effort was put into improving the way GPs, you know, deal with mental health problems and training and blah, blah, blah. And that's all good. But if that's all you do, and yet you don't do anything to address what people know and believe about their mental health, can they recognize that they might have a problem? Do they believe that going to a professional will be helpful? Do they believe that taking medication or having psychotherapy, if they don't believe all those things are helpful and they don't recognize and they don't see the value of it, you could have the best services in the world, but no one's going to go. So you kind of need to think about, if you want to think about narrowing that gap, you need to think about the structural issues, as in there need to be services, and then you need to address the other part of that, which is you need to do what it takes to support people to go. So that's the kind of the mental health literacy piece of that. And so Tony Jorm, who I mentioned before, is a real pioneer in that area.
Okay. So, yeah, and I think that is, and we will, because that is especially one of the topics, and it's a very nice bridge into that, is because when we talk about diversity, we always say that, and our background, of course, as openly gay men, is to say that if we need to change these things, we need to talk about it and be vocal about our approach to diversity and internationalization. But I think, as you said yourself, mental health issues can still be taboo and be difficult to talk about because of the stigma. How do you, at the workplace, open a discussion about mental health, no matter what role you have in it? And I think particularly if you're not, we want to help the people with the issue. It shouldn't be left to them to open this discussion because they have more than enough to work with as it is.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I mean, I really agree with you in terms of framing this. There's sort of more than one way to look at it. But if you're thinking about it from a perspective of diversity, I mean, I completely agree, diversity in, you know, in all ways. And it depends, I think, perhaps in some areas this is more valued than in others. I think people, you know, there is some, you know, when we talk about stigma, we're often focused on kind of the negatives and things not to do, and we don't think so much about the contribution that people with, say, diverse mental health histories can bring. But certainly probably the area where this is best developed and where people are most valued is in what we call the peer workforce. So people who have histories of mental health problems working in where their lived experience is a really important part of their role. And they bring an understanding that people who don't have those experiences can't have. So I work in mental health research and I do a lot of work in stigma, but I personally don't have a history of mental health problems. So certainly having people in my team, which I do, to give me the perspective on some of the work we do is really valuable and brings just an extra dimension to the work we do. And, you know, sometimes I might say something or have an assumption and someone will say, well, actually, you know, you're not thinking about that from the perspective of a person with lived experience, and this person would think about it in this way. And I'm like, great, thank you. That's so valuable that you're bringing these different perspectives and things I haven't thought of. So I think we need to do better. We need to probably do more work as researchers in research, working in mental health research ourselves, as well as communicating those things out to the broader community, not just being about what the problems might be, but what the value and the contribution people can make. I think that's really important.
Yeah, and one of the things that we would say is, of course, that bringing that perspective makes you think about a group of the population that you probably wouldn't think about yourself, both when it comes to taking them into consideration for the design of a research project, but certainly also when it comes to the research communication. And perhaps it would, this is of course difficult, but could you give us some idea of how large a part of the population we're talking about when we're talking mental health issues? And that's of course depends on the definition, but some just to have some sort of rough idea.
So yes, I can give you an idea of that. So there's various different ways that you might look at that. Some people, the way we usually think about that is around 12-month prevalence, which means that in any 12-month period, what percentage of people might be likely to meet the criteria for, say, for depression. So I'm most familiar with the statistics in Australia. So the most recent data that we have, which is actually from 2007, would say that around in any 12-month period, around 6%, a little bit more than 6% of people might have depression. Mm-hmm. Around 14% might meet the criteria for an anxiety disorder. And there are other types of mental health condition that, say, like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, they are lower prevalence, so they'll sometimes get called lower prevalence problems. And schizophrenia might be sort of up to about, it's not quite so clear, but up to about 1%. Bipolar disorder might be between 2 and 5%. And then personality disorders, that's a bit unclear, but could even be as high as 10%, some people think. So it really does depend on what kind of mental health condition you're talking about.
Sure.
A statistic you'll often hear is 1 in 4, mm-hmm. and 1 in 5, and that's tends to be depression, anxiety, and substance use problems. And then what you will often hear is 1 in 5 of the general population and 1 in 4 young people. And that increase in young people, most of that actually is as a result of substance use. So people often hear that statistic and think, oh, more young people have depression and anxiety. Actually, they don't. It's probably a bit higher in a slightly older age group, but they tend to have more substance use problems, which decline with age.
Yeah. No, but still, no matter how you, the specifics of the statistics, you can say it's a quite high part of the population. That
it's common. That I think everybody either has that experience or knows someone with depression. Much less common for, say, schizophrenia, for example, but I think most people would know someone with depression or anxiety, for example.
Yeah. Thinking about stigma for a minute, I mean, we our models of thinking about diseases, if you think about other diseases, you know, people tend to think about getting cured, you know, people, and, you know, there are certain diseases which, or conditions that people might think about that you might manage over a lifetime. But is part of the stigma around mental health the fact that people feel like you should be cured from it, and managing mental health is seen as a problem if you have depression or anxiety or some other condition. And is that seen as a weakness and part of the stigma still, do you think?
I think there's a number of things that drive stigma. So people tend to talk about, and some of the work we've done has looked at this, like people tend to think about stigma as a sort of one-dimensional thing, but actually it's not, and different things drive it. So for example, take depression. A common stigmatizing attitude around, say, depression is that it's a personal weakness, and people just need to pull themselves together and they can snap out of it, you know, and that might be a common belief about depression. Whereas, say, something like schizophrenia, the attitudes around that are not that so much, but they are more around dangerousness and unpredictability and, you know, driven quite a bit by the media. So what we've done, and we've done work in Australia to show this with large national population surveys, is with the kind of effort we've put in through organisations. We have an organisation in Australia called Beyond Blue who've done a lot of work around educating people in the community around depression, anxiety and now suicide. We've done quite well in changing perceptions of mental illness, but definitely depression, anxiety. It's about personal weakness. People don't really have that belief quite so much anymore. A bit, but beliefs around dangerousness and particularly around lower prevalence mental health conditions, we haven't really managed to shift those beliefs. Yeah. And I know in the UK they've had Time to Change, which is a big mental health awareness campaign. And I think now they also think, because I know some, you know, people involved in that, they now think they need to focus possibly on less common conditions and in more hard to reach parts of the population. So yeah, they might be with lower levels of education, they might be maybe culturally and linguistically diverse and lower prevalence mental health. So, you know, we need to kind of do something about that now. I think there's a general agreement in that.
So the change that that has happened in terms of perceptions and beliefs and stigmas around depression and anxiety, is that flowed through, do you think, into the workplace more generally? And it's easier to be open about those issues in the workplace now?
Yeah, I think we have enough data to suggest. So again, we've done work where we ask people whether they disclosed, whether they had a mental health condition, and People are more likely to disclose that now, and you're more likely to know someone. So we think that we have made some progress there, and there is a bit more tolerance of that. I think it depends again on the environment. So certain, you know, in certain organisations, certain workplaces, it's easier to do that than others. There's still, yeah, it depends. I think everything, I mean, all these things are always context dependent to a degree. But I think we can say we are more open about that now. Yeah. But there's probably more awareness of, more willingness, more awareness of the issues around it, and more willingness of organisations, particularly large organisations who tend to have the resources. That's probably one of the key things, actually. To address this.
Yeah, and I've just in a bit in line of, with that, but also perhaps moving it a bit. It's when we talk about diversity as culture, and it could be gender, it could be sexuality, ethnicity, etc. Then what we do is, of course, we want to say we want the workplace to be as diverse as possible. And we want to make room for everybody to be themselves. And when it comes to mental health issues, it could be, I think it's tricky because we want to make room for discussions about this. And we want to, and make room for them to be themselves with these issues they might have, but we also want to make room for them to improve their mental health. So how do we strike this balance in the workplace so that we actually
talk about it and see it as having mental health issues, saying that it's an activist, probably pushing it a bit, but saying that your lived experience has value in and of itself without locking them in that stage of their issues.
Yeah, I suppose like any culture, you know, and you would have heard this talked about before, it's got to be a combination of top down and bottom up. Like, you know, leadership, if leadership model openness about their own mental health and tolerance, that's not the right word, but, you know, and openness and valuing of diversity, then that kind of flows through to the rest of the organisation. So a recent example that springs to mind is in our local Victoria Police, you know, they've certainly had concerns around the mental health of that workforce. And last year, I think the chief constable, you know, talked about that he was going to take time off because of his mental health. And, you know, so really trying to model that openness and non-stigmatizing attitudes. And I think obviously that needs to flow through to all levels of the organization, you know, it is acceptable to talk about these problems if they're problems, and to be able to have some flexibility in what you might need. You know, do you, and that's a really important part of it actually, in terms of offering as much flexibility as possible so people can have, you know, still make a contribution and be productive, but have, you know, the workplace be able to adapt to the extent that it can. Mm-hmm. So they're supported to make the contribution that they can absolutely make.
Do you think the academic environment is a trendsetter or behind pace when it comes to these issues in Australia?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think because it tends to be generally more progressive, I would say that there is, you know, there's less stigma, probably less discrimination and more openness to, I mean, I work in the Centre for Mental Health, so you often get people interested in working in mental health because they have their own history or they have a family history, so that's quite common.
Yeah.
So I would say that in some ways it is. The probably the where it isn't good, very easy, is that being a researcher is really competitive and quite hard going. You know, it's hard bloody work. And you know, there's some really good people. There aren't enough jobs for everyone with PhDs who wants to work in research. So, you know, your hours are long and your workload's quite big, and that can be a hard thing to manage. That's probably the downside of it in terms of if you need more time or more flexibility, that can be hard.
Yeah,
it's pressure in that way, and it's insecure. Yeah. It's got a lot of, so when you look at the research evidence around what characteristics of work are good or bad for your mental health, well, obviously bullying is really bad, but the other one is around job demand and control. So academics often have a lot of demands on them, but they have a lot of autonomy about how they do the work, you know. A lot of people work from home part-time, they travel, and there's a lot of autonomy about how you meet those demands. So the demands are high, but you have a lot of autonomy. Whereas if you have a job with a lot of demand and not much control over how you do your work, that's detrimental to your mental health.
No, I just, a short comment on what you said, especially about leadership and leadership showing vulnerability, which I think was a very good point in taking the lead in it, because I remember when I used to work in a university, I had to take some time off because of work related stress, and came back, and it was a tricky thing, because so much of the initiative on how to work with this and talk about it and was left with me, and I had a colleague who had been off because of other reasons. And I talked to her about this, about getting back, and she said, oh, but you have to understand, it requires a good health to be ill.
Right.
And I think that's that was a really important point, that if sometimes that if leadership doesn't take the initiative, you leave it to the person who is coming back from being ill and still is not a fully recovered, probably. So you, and then yeah, so you suddenly you need a really good health to be able to get back. And the I just think I enjoy the irony of it, but it's because it would be funny if it wasn't sad.
Yes. So I did, it's definitely true that that's an issue coming to work, coming back to work after a broken arm is, you know, people want to say, but oh, well, it's just should be just like a broken arm, but actually we probably know that it really isn't. Yeah. And so I have done projects to develop, you know, best practice guidelines and a website around return to work after someone's been absent with an episode of depression or anxiety. And I think, in the main, the important thing to remember is that most people probably do want to do the right thing. Yeah. Like most managers want to help support the person. The colleagues want to support the person. Most people have good, I mean, there'd be the odd few that don't. But in the main, people want to do that. But often what you find is they're just not, they don't want to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. So I think giving people a bit of guidance on that, and I think being open. So for example, you know, there's no one thing to say to somebody that's had depression, because of course it completely depends on the context of your relationship. If you had a good relationship beforehand and your communication was good and you could talk about things, then you know you can build on that. It's not like there's a formula for the right thing to say. Mm. But I think there's ways to go about structuring things. So for example, someone's coming back, you know, you need to have a conversation about, okay, well, how do you want to come back? Do you want to come back a day a week to start? Is it 2 days a week? Yeah. How will we know if you're not managing? You know, how will we, what are we going to do if you're really not managing? How are we going to set up, will we meet once a month? Will I check in with you once a week? Would you like to do that face to face? Would you like to do that on the phone? It's like having those conversations about how it's going to work for both parties and just trying to be open about that and make plans is the way, and bringing that goodwill to it is the way to go.
Yeah. Mm. I think I think it's interesting how, I mean, it's not no matter what sort of minority issues we might talk about, but in the end, it often, the approach is basically always the same, is you need to be open about it. You need to be vocal about it. And we understand you don't want, that it is difficult and you don't want to make mistakes, but it's better to be upfront about that and say, I'm going to try this. And if I do something wrong, correct me. But but if we all just do nothing, nothing is going to change, no matter if it is about mental health, sexuality, gender, race, whatever we're talking about.
True. And I think that's largely true, but I don't think we should shy away from the fact that in some contexts being open isn't a good thing necessarily. Like I think it's going to be an individual decision. So I know people in the UK and, for example, that have done work around decision tools, decision aids. Mm-hmm. Do I disclose this or not? Yes. So I don't think we should, in an ideal world, of course, everyone could be open about everything, but we don't live in an ideal world, you know? No. So for some people, that decision about disclosing whatever it is, but mental health is the thing I think about, is a decision that needs to be worked through, because there will be people for whom that is a disadvantage.
Yeah, no, I'm...
certainly you do hear stories of that.
Yeah, I know. I certainly agree. I was more thinking, if you are in the situation we talked about before, if you are coming back to work and basically everybody knows about it, then the way to go around it is for everybody to be as open. And it's better to try and make mistakes than doing nothing with good intentions.
Yes, I think that's true. And, you know, I have had people working for me in the past and who've, you know, gone through times of struggle, and that's true in COVID. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of our conversations have been about, well, what can I do? What do you need? What can I do to support you within the constraints of the relationship? As in, I'm their supervisor, I'm not their friend or their mum. You know, within the constraints of the relationship, what can we do here to, make this easier rather than harder? Yeah. Because that's another thing that can happen. You can get a bit drawn into being overly responsible, and that's not necessarily the way to go. I mean, it isn't really the way to go in a workplace.
We understand you've looked at some intersectional issues around gender, ethnic minority groups, and things like that with mental health. Could you talk a little bit about that and what you found?
I wouldn't say that was my main area of expertise, and I think we probably need to do better in that. So I've just done a large project with doing a whole lot of consultations to inform, because part of the one of the priority areas in Australia's fifth National Mental Health and Suicide Prevention Plan is around reducing stigma and discrimination, particularly to lower prevalence mental health conditions. Yep. And you always, in those cases, of course, want whatever you do to be inclusive of culturally and linguistically diverse communities, and also in Australia, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Yep. And I think we know some things. And of course, cultural groups vary. They're not a homogenous group. You know, things are going to be different in different groups. Sometimes there will be higher levels of stigma. So I do work, for example, in China, and trying to culturally adapt some mental health promotion, community mental health programs. And so one of the differences might be around the role of family. So Western cultures, you know, it's a bit of a stereotype, but it holds true to some extent, tend to be a bit more about the autonomy of the individual, whereas the family unit might predominate in China, so that might have more of a role. And then what you say to people outside your family, you tend to keep, they might be more inclined to keep things within the family, and there might be shame brought on the family rather than just on the individual. They might think that, or other people might, or they worry that other people might judge them. So that's a bit different. So the other thing is around the autonomy of the person. The family might expect to have a more of a role in decisions about treatment or looking after the person, particularly in places where there really aren't health services. It might fall much more to the family. So there's some of those differences there, actually. The other thing you might hear is in some cultures, experiences is a more blurry boundary between experiences that you might, you know, that might meet the criteria for a diagnosis. You know, hearing voices might be one example. If you, you know, have in your cultural traditions that your ancestors or spirits or whatever speak to you, and that's part of how you understand your culture, and that's not psychosis necessarily. You know, whereas so these, you know, just understanding those differences is really important.
That's fascinating. I'd never really thought about that, but because you know, a lot of the stuff we do, we think about sort of cultural differences in different aspects of diversity and what, how that can impact on international research collaborations in particular, you know, when you're working with people from different cultures and if you're coming from a minority group or a different perspective. But I hadn't really thought about it in the context of mental health. But yes, different cultures may treat what we might see as a mental health problem very differently, and vice versa.
So we, one of the things that we, I mean, many of our listeners say are research managers and administrators. And so in that particular role where they're supporting researchers either at the application level or during a project, what could they do to to promote the topic of mental health when working with researchers and projects and make it a better place and take it into consideration throughout the life of a research project?
Yes, I think again, thinking about when we think about what are the risks to mental health. So, you know, when we think about workplace risks, we think about the job demand and control that I talked about before. So you want to make sure people have as much autonomy, you know, to have the support. So they have that autonomy. The other thing is that supervisor or manager or support kind of buffers that stress relationship. So if you might have quite a demanding job, but you've got some control over it, but getting support around that helps manage the stress of that. Some of the other things that we know about are around what we call effort-reward imbalance. So if you feel like you're really working really hard, and we're not just talking about money here, and no one is valuing, you know, you get no positive feedback around, you know, the work that you're doing and the effort you're putting in, then that can grind you down a bit. And the other thing that perhaps other people have done work in is around what you might call organizational justice. So if you've got a couple of people, you know, in the same situation and the processes are around transparency and fairness and, you know, people being treated equally, and if that's not there and you feel like you have an issue and you get, you know, punished for it or it's not dealt with well and someone else gets special treatment, you know, these things can grind you down over time. So making sure that those aspects of a workplace are kind of well in place. Also, bullying and harassment is a well-known risk as well. So, you know, those things are definitely going to be damaging to people in any workplace.
The point about research design is interesting because, again, you know, we encourage researchers that we've worked with to think about their research design and the impact that it might have on effectively the community they're researching or whatever their research problem is.
Yeah.
And that's clearly very important, and it's very important within mental health as well. But as you rightly just pointed out, that has to go very much for the research team as well. Like, make sure that the research design is actually, you know, perhaps realistic. You know, you're not trying to do too much in too short a period of time with the lack of resources and things like that, which could impact mental health. So I think that's a really, really important point. And that's perhaps something that we can all get better at on the research management and research administrator, being that critical friend to work with researchers on that.
And look, certainly, you know, because research is a demanding job and senior people do work really hard, and sometimes they maybe put unrealistic pressure on those under them, or they don't. The other issue you sometimes hear about in research is younger, more junior researchers not getting the credit. You know, maybe they're not the first author on the paper and they should be. And, you know, these sorts of things, like that's certainly getting those issues around equity and fairness that comes into the organisational justice. That's really important. The other thing is that we shouldn't be doing research that increase inequalities. You know, we shouldn't be doing the kind of research really that is benefiting a certain already advantaged part of the population because they're easy to reach. You know, you always got to be trying to consider that and obviously risk as well, you know, and we're required to do this anyway. Ethics committees require us to consider all those things. So those are really important things.
And then when trying to take care of each other within the research groups, that's obviously a lot easier when we are face to face with each other.
Yeah.
And we are not right now. So I think we can't let you go without having a bit of a COVID chat and mental health issues, because it's obviously difficult to a lot of people to work under these conditions, and we probably will see some sort of spike in mental health issues, perhaps already are. So one thing is, how do we, and at the same time, we are of course a lot more stressed out because these are difficult conditions to work under, and certainly the kids are at home and all these things. We're under a lot of pressure under in different conditions, how do we try to look out for each other and in the best way under these very strange conditions?
Yeah, look, certainly it's an issue, and I'm sure, like you, or like me, you're spending a lot more time on Zoom talking to people. And certainly, you know, we talked a lot about this when we moved in March to working at home, and was a lot of focus on making sure people knew that they could ask for help when they needed it. You know, a couple of people that I work with just checking in more frequently, particularly in this period, it's been a bit harder on the people that live alone, particularly if you've got younger members of your team. And I'm really conscious for those people, trying to just make sure that I check in more frequently. I'm realistic about and have discussions about, well, the workload they can manage, and do that, and encourage, you know, where you really think maybe things are not going well, encourage them to get professional help, whether that's, you know, going to the GP for the first time, whether it's maybe making an appointment with a psychologist they've seen before, or certainly very strongly encouraging that. And the self-help stuff, like go for a walk, you know, try and get out, go for a walk at lunchtime, or, you know, try and make sure you get your good sleep hygiene, that you're eating well, that you're trying to reach out to friends for support in, you know, whether it's, if you can, face-to-face, but if you can't, at least on the phone. So just trying to, you know, encourage all those things. You feel a bit powerless, but that's like what, you know, those are some of the things that we've been trying to do. And doing things like having Zoom drinks and things like that, which are, you know,
yeah,
and the novelty of that is wearing off, but anyway, yeah. Well and truly worn off.
Certainly, but we might just have to get used to it. It was at an EU conference here about their research and innovation days, where they talked about research foresight and also in the mental health or in health area, and where there was a health researcher who said that what he needed right now was a discussion about this, what we experience now, probably being the how we were going to live until the end of 2023.
Wow, 2023. Wow.
Even if we saw a vaccine next year, the time it took for people to get a vaccine, possible mutations, etc. To some extent, this was how we're going to live until 2023. And I don't know. I thought it was a rough one to hear.
Let's hope that's let's hope he's completely wrong.
But it does speak for the importance of getting these new routines up and running, and also when it comes to mental health and checking in on each other, developing routines in these areas, because it might not change just next month.
No, I think that's exactly right. And also maybe thinking about ways to prioritise, you know, who's going to come back into the office first, how are we going to do things, you know, just making sure that people who need it get priority when we get to that point. Because, you know, we maybe will have half the people come in one week and half the people, you know, however that happens, just making sure that, and I think it has been in at least where I work, but making sure that mental health and people's mental health and those mental health needs are part of the decision making. Like, it isn't just a business decision, a business led decision. It's a person centered, you know, decision as well about, well, this person is quite happy working from home. They actually love it. But this person, not so much. They would prefer to come back in because they've really struggled living on their own. And that's part of the decision making, rather than, well, you do this job so you come back, or, you know, whatever. Okay. I think just need to make sure that happens.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important. We've got into a bit of a conversation here in the UK where, you know, people talk about the freedoms and the joys of working from home, and I've done it for a few years, and I am fairly well adapted to it. I spent a lot more time in coffee shops pre-lockdown than I do now. But there's other people I know who have been forced to work from home who are really finding it difficult. And they would actually prefer to be going back into the office and don't like all this talk about, you know, let's all just work from home forever, which is clearly unfeasible anyway. But I think you're right. I think that's a really important consideration.
Yes, I think it's, and it's got to be about, what the person, I mean, I personally would not want to work at home full time, but I might work at home a bit more, but I like the social interaction of work, like discussions and meetings, bumping into someone and having a chat about something that then, you know, is just enjoyable in and of itself, but may also lead to, you know, a work project happening that might not have otherwise. So, you know, all those things. Personally, that would not suit me to not have those things.
Yeah, no, agreed. I think that makes a lot of sense and needs to be considered.
Okay, I think we do want to be respectful of your time. And thank you very much for joining us today. And it has been a pleasure. And I have several notes here about things to follow up on and topics we should try and cover in future episodes. So thank you for appearing here, Nicola.
Pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, Nicola. Thanks.
And that was our talk with Nicola. What were the points that you paid particular notice to, Lachlan?
A fascinating chat. I mean, mental health research is a huge area at the moment. I mean, understanding where people are at, particularly right now with COVID and the impacts that that's had, over and above everything else that Nicola talked about in terms of the mental health research she's done, mental health stigma, understanding definitions of mental health and why it's contested, why certain issues within mental health contested, was a really interesting chat. But I think one of the things that really resonated for me was the idea that it's accepted widely in mental health research now. The idea that there's nothing about us without us, and that to do mental health research, you need to both involve and value the inputs of people who have experience of mental health. And I think sometimes we still don't always get that right when we're talking about other minority groups. It's encouraging that we are in a much better position around that with mental health, but I think there's a lesson for research with other minority groups around nothing about us without us. So that was a really positive slogan. It's a really simple slogan to remember as well, actually, which is great. But one of the things that sort of stems from that is around cultural approaches to mental health and cultural understandings, I guess, of mental health. I mean, we've talked a lot in this podcast around international research collaborations, how you work with partners from different parts of the world and different cultures. But Nicola was making the point that different cultures will also see mental health in through different lenses. And actually what we might see as a mental health problem here in the UK or in Europe or in North America or Australia may not be seen as a mental health problem in other parts of the world, and vice versa. You know, I think that's incredibly important, and it's incredibly important then to make sure that these conversations continue, be it mental health research or other types of research, and getting different perspectives is incredibly important.
Yeah, and if we could just return to the first point about including people with the lived experience. I also, in that connection, think it was interesting to hear her perspectives on leadership and the importance of leadership showing vulnerability and the role that could play in that, because also when you look at the sheer numbers she mentioned, you can see that it is a significant part of the population who have had mental health issues within the last 12 months. So the chance of having someone within the department in a research project group or research support office for that matter who has suffered from mental health issues is quite high. And it is so the slogan, and you mentioned it could be probably be quite easier to follow if leadership was willing to show the vulnerability and share when they had suffered from some of these issues, which of course will be a difficult cultural thing because so many of the cultures we live in and we look to towards are very masculine cultures, and showing vulnerability isn't a classic masculine virtue, is it?
It's not, and I'm sure some of that correlates strongly with what Nicola talked about in terms of research into the stigma around mental health, and perhaps yeah. In masculine cultures, the stigma is greater as well in regards to mental health. But it was encouraging, I guess, to note that in certain contexts, certainly within an Australian context, and I think in the UK and other cultures, the stigma is decreasing. It's still there. But it is decreasing, and it is easier or becoming easier for people to be more vulnerable, which is then in turn hopefully making work environments and research environments are better for people for mental health. But I still think there's a long way to go. I mean, I think it was quite telling when we asked Nicola about, you know, whether she thought universities and higher education institutions were good, perhaps model employers when it came to mental health. I think for her, working in a mental health school around public policy and health, you know, generally it was felt to be pretty good. But in other disciplines, other universities, perhaps there's still quite a little bit of work to do. And I think that's probably the case. I think the evidence would suggest that there's still some way to go on that.
Yeah, I think it's a... It's good that we have people like Nicola and her co-researchers who can give us both the data and show us what to do, and show things like she mentioned the help seeking gap, and showing the need that is out there, and help us how to work on that. And that is of course a responsibility of all of us to be aware of that and help people get the help needed, and not surround seeing a therapist and stuff like that with the stigma that it has been in the past, at least.
Yeah, and that help seeking gap applies in all contexts, doesn't it? I mean, just enabling the services is not enough. The people who need or want to use those services need to know that they're both there, and that they can get help, and that they need to acknowledge or recognize the challenges they face themselves in order to get that help. So I think that was a really interesting perspective. And I think Nicola's research and her team's research is helping to just unpick further issues around stigma and access to services, and hopefully, and I know she's only done a little bit of work in it, but across cultures as well, into minority ethnic communities and the like, which is really positive.
Yeah, and it is of course in the name that I really like, the mental health literacy. That we don't really necessarily all of us have the right vocabulary to talk about this and deal with this, and we need to develop a literacy around this topic in order to help people, but also to just appreciate the experience you have from what you've been through as part of a SA team.
Yeah, and we talk about this, don't we, when we've talked about it on the podcast, we talked about it on the different workshops and things that we've run with different universities, is that the communication has got to be there from leadership, from team managers and things like that, and to help, you know, be open and vulnerable and increase literacy, mental health literacy, and this kind of thing. And it crosses all the whole spectrum of diversity and inclusion. You know, communication is such an important part of this, communication and education. One other interesting point that she made, I think, and I think this certainly applies to a lot of universities now, and it certainly applies in Europe, Australia, UK, probably North America and other parts of the world, is that, you know, as we battle COVID and people have been working from home in a lot of cases, particularly in higher education sector, there's been a real a push from some people, I suppose, to just keep working from home. But as we discussed with Nicola, that's not going to be right for everybody. And actually, to support people's mental health, there'll be people who actually need to go back into the office and try. And I think Nicola was saying she would quite like to go back into the office, maybe not full time, but certainly for part of the time. And I think it's important to recognize that mental health isn't all about staying at home, or good mental health isn't all about staying at home and working. Good mental health can be achieved for different people in different settings, and how we move back towards research environments which can have people meeting face to face is going to be really important, I think, for both the quality of the research, but also for people's mental health going forward.
Yeah, quality of life would definitely increase the moment we could see each other again face to face. Because, as we also talked about in the interview, it's just difficult to check in with one another the same way on Zoom or Skype or Teams or wherever you're meeting, or through an email. The more difficult it is, the more important it is that we keep trying and developing ways of actually doing that.
Agreed. Completely agreed. So yeah, that was a great chat. It was great to have Nicola on the program. We have more interesting guests lined up over the next few weeks. Looking forward to bringing them to you. We won't tell you too much about them now. We'll tell you a bit more about them in the coming weeks. Thank you for listening. Do get in touch if you've got feedback or questions or ideas. Do rate and review us wherever you listen to your podcast, and do make sure you follow us on Twitter at DivresPod, DivresPod. And we look forward to speaking to you again in a couple of weeks' time.
Yep. Talk to you soon.
That's great. Cheers. See you later.
Bye.